It is
11:12.
Mr. Phillips, I'm Tom Krebs. I'm a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I have with me for right now Mr. John Armstrong, who is going to leave here in a bit to carry on other duties. And I anticipate that in the couple of minutes, Bob Hinckley, who is also counsel here at the FCIC, will join us. Ms. Mina Simhai may join us later on. Is it all right with you if we go ahead and do we have your permission to record this conversation? Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. We are, for purposes of this inquiry, federal employees, so that under 18 U.S.C. Code Section 1001, false statements are given to us in the conduct of our duties are actionable. I do not anticipate that from you, but I am obligated to advise you of that at the outset of these proceedings. You understand that, sir? Thank you. Who else is there with you, Mr. Phillips? And Mark, is there anyone else there with you?
Stephen Cohn, the general counsel of Clayton, is also present with us.
Thank you. Mr. Phillips, can you give us a little bit of your background, please, sir?
Sure. Where would you like me to start?
Well, I guess if somebody asked me that question, I'd have to go way back, but because I anticipate...
So would I. That's what I'm afraid this could be a long interview.
Let's just hit the high points. Education.
Okay, education. I have a bachelor's degree in economics from Rutgers, and I have an MBA from NYU in corporate finance and international business. After that, I joined the Chase Bank as a credit analyst and spent about 4 or 5 years at the Chase Bank as a corporate lending officer in the international division with focus in the Far East Asia group. After Chase, I went to AIG, where I was there for about 15 or 16 years in various financial and investment positions. And when I left AIG in 1992, I left as the vice president and corporate treasurer. I left AIG and went to a mortgage guarantee insurance company, which was then known as Commonwealth Mortgage Assurance Company, later changed its name to Radian Guaranty. And I initially joined that company as the senior vice president and chief financial officer, and ultimately rose to the position of chairman and chief executive officer. I retired from Radian in 2005, and shortly thereafter, I joined Clayton as chairman and CEO, where I was until July of 2008, when Clayton was sold. Sort of as a brief timeline, that's who I am.
Can you tell us a little bit, please, Mr. Phillips, about the activities and the business of Clayton Holdings?
Sure. Clayton Holdings owned Clayton Services, which is a due diligence and analytics firm. And also owned Clayton Fixed Income Services, which is a surveillance and credit monitoring firm. Both firms specialized and focused their activities in the mortgage-backed securities world. Clayton Services primarily provided what we would call front-end services, which included services such as due diligence and Clayton Fixed Income primarily provided back-end services, which would have comprised surveillance and credit risk management.
Very good. Thank you, sir. How did Clayton go about the conduct of its front-end services for due diligence in connection with mortgage-backed securities?
Well, we provided due diligence analytics either at field offices of the mortgage loan sellers, which we would have called, you know, on-site work.
Mm-hmm.
We also had a centralized unit, which was located, first in Sheldon, Connecticut, and then in Tampa, Florida, where we provided, you know, a centralized due diligence product offering as well. It depended upon the ability of our clients to harvest data and provide it to us in an electronic way as to whether or not we were able to provide that service in a centralized fashion. If the work files that we were looking at were hard copy, we would send our analysts to the field where they would review the hard copy data that was provided to them.
As early on, presumably most of your work would have been done at the on-site or in the field, as you described it. At what point in time did you begin to transfer activities to the centralized sites at Shelton and Tampa?
I believe when I got to Clayton, I believe it was probably about 85% of the work, something in that range, but 85% of the work was done in the field and 15% of the work was done in a centralized location. And by the time I left, or in 2008, of course, the diligence world had changed by then because of the crisis that occurred and the tremendous pullback in just the level of mortgage-backed securities. But by that time, it had probably gotten, I would say, down to maybe 60% in the field and 40% in centralized units, you know, something along those lines. It really started to morph in 2006 and 7 as firms began to be able to electronically capture the data and the information. They were able to retrieve it, index it electronically in a good form, and we were able to use it much more effectively that way.
Can you describe for us the methodology, the conduct of the due diligence process at both the off-site and on-site facilities and at the centralized facilities?
I'm not sure what you mean by the conduct.
Well, I'm particularly interested in one. How did you go about acquiring the folks, the underwriters? How did you go about acquiring QC personnel? How did you go about determining who the lead would be? And how often were those leads, in fact, asked for or utilized by persons who had occasion to have been involved with them in prior due diligence reviews?
I can tell you how, you know, I think we acquired people. That was through either our own advertising or through sort of in-industry word of mouth. The traveling analyst community is a well-defined community. Everyone knows each other because they all run into each other at various client sites, and they pass along from one to another clients' interest in expanding their universe of traveling underwriters, and so It was through direct advertising or through through word of mouth.
Did the underwriters that you acquired usually work for Clayton 1 week or 1 month and for someone else another month or another on another job?
Many of our analysts or underwriters were predominantly Clayton. And in the years of 2005, 6, and 7, when we were very, very busy, they probably worked almost exclusively for Clayton because we were able to keep them employed as much time as they wanted to be employed. Prior to that, they probably worked for more than one company and traveled amongst the companies following the demand for the service.
What type of training did Clayton provide the underwriters to be certain that they were at least familiar with their duties required of them?
We had an extensive training segment that, as I recall, required underwriters to spend at least 2 full weeks in training before they were ever allowed to work on a client file live, and then there was ongoing training, as products changed, as our systems changed, as our analytics changed. So there was initial and then regular ongoing training for each of the underwriters on a periodic and fairly regular basis.
Was it typical for an underwriter to progress up the chain, so to speak, to QC and then maybe to a lead if he or she were particularly had proven capable?
That would probably be a good progression. Yeah, I'm not sure I would say it was usual, but I would say that was the normal progression for many of our people. I think we got most, if not all, of our leads, who progressed up that chain.
Was additional training provided to persons or personnel as they moved up the chain?
I would imagine there was, but I honestly can't speak to the level of the training that was provided upon, a person's promotion or elevation.
Let me shift gears a little bit on you. What was the purpose of the due diligence?
Well, we were hired by our clients to review various data elements contained in mortgage loan files. Each client typically had their own what we would call underwriting script, and that script outlined for us at Clayton what elements we were to review, how we were to utilize them, and how we were to report back to our clients the findings that that we produced as a result of our review of that data.
How would these scripts vary from firm to firm?
Let's see, they would vary by the number of elements that we reviewed. They would vary by some of the metrics that were developed. They would vary by the way we would report back to the client.
What metrics, the way the metrics developed, I don't understand that aspect of your answer.
By metrics, what I mean is the analytics that were developed by our underwriters as to loans that were fully compliant with standards that were underwriting standards that that we were underwriting to, loans that met most of the standards but not all, or loans that would have had significant deficiencies.
When a given client came to Clayton to employ them to conduct due diligence, what was it that they anticipated? Well, let me strike that. Are you familiar with the bid process for the acquisition of loans? In loan pools?
I am as an observer, right, but I've never participated in the bid process myself.
What did you observe about that process? How was it conducted?
Typically, a seller of a pool would announce that they had a pool with certain loan characteristics for sale, and they would offer that to a number of potential buyers. The buyers, if they were interested, would receive what was called a bid tape, from which they would then perform their own analysis of the underlying loan, and provide then a bid to purchase that pool of loans.
Was one of the elements of the bid process the percentage of the loans that was to be subjected to due diligence in the pool?
I don't believe that was an element.
Go ahead.
There's, as I'm sure you're aware, since you've been, you know, undertaking this review, things changed rapidly in the years leading up to the crisis of 2007, and so at some point in time, the sellers who became empowered in their selling because the bidders were so aggressive would actually limit the amount of files that they would submit to due diligence. And so, they would perhaps say, and again, I have no firsthand knowledge of this,
but go ahead,
I did not directly participate, but I'm told they would say, okay, not, you know, you can do due diligence, but it cannot be greater than. And they would cite a percentage.
Uh-huh. Was there anything that, at your term of management there, Clayton, did you come to understand that there was a specific percentage that was more or less usual for the business?
More or less usual, I would say the average size of file that we looked at during my tenure at Clayton was probably 10% of ish.
Was that due diligence review conducted to confirm that the data points contained in the materials forwarded by the loan pool originator were generally accurate, or was it conducted to provide information necessary to describe the pool for securitization investors?
The work that we did at Clayton was for our clients. So we would have been working to provide our clients with verification of the income of the data within the mortgage files. We did not provide, nor did we ever contemplate providing information that was to be delivered to or even utilized by potential investors.
Were the results of the due diligence review conducted by Clayton on behalf of certain clients, was that published, referenced, or otherwise disclosed in prospectuses, to your knowledge?
The specific data was, to my knowledge, not disclosed generally in prospectus. There may have occasionally been a reference that diligence was undertaken, but I don't believe I ever saw the results of that due diligence work provided within a prospectus in any specificity.
Thank you. Bob Hinckley has joined us, by the way, and John is still here with us. John. And Bob?
Good morning, Mr. Phillips. Thank you very much.
Hi, Bob.
Did you have any knowledge after the sample came in? Well, let me start with this. Did you get a sample, or did you get the full loan tape and then chose the sample?
Oh, to my knowledge, we never chose the sample. We were always provided the sample.
So you would get less than the full loan tape. You'd get files on certain loans that were made up the loan portfolio.
We would get files that comprised the sample that we were asked to underwrite or to review. That's correct.
Okay. And then you would do your due diligence review, and essentially what you would tell your client was the use this word closely, a scoring on the quality of the sample. In other words, correct me if I'm wrong, but you got back to the client and you said, yeah, a certain percentage of these are comply with guidelines, a certain percentage don't, but there are sufficient compensating factors to have underwritten the loan, and then there is a certain percentage that do not comply with guidelines, and there is an absence of compensating factors. Is that more or less correct?
Yeah, that's generally correct. That's right.
Hey, you want to amplify or tell me where I'm wrong on any of that?
No, you pretty much have it well identified. So I think that's pretty good.
My understanding is that this process went on usually over a limited period of time.
Our assignments usually lasted from several days up to a maximum that I recall of 2 weeks. I personally don't recall any analytic assignment going on for greater than 2 weeks. 2 weeks was about the longest that I recall. Most of them lasted between 3 and 6 business days.
All right, and in some cases, well, tell me what you if this is right. The process was iterative. In other words, you would get back to the client on a daily basis with the files that had been reviewed and the results of those files?
That's correct. We would compile reports daily to our clients so that the client would be able to utilize the information that we provided them at the end of every day to, for whatever purposes they generally put that to. For example, for loans that we might have said generally met standards but may have had a few deficiencies but were offset by compensating factors, the clients would review those files often themselves and determine if the compensating factors that we identified were sufficient to mitigate the deficiencies that were found. So yes, we did that every day.
So they were they were checking the quality of your work then?
They were reviewing the output of our analysts along the time path. Let's go back to the bid tape, for example. You know, when you first received a bid tape, you may have received that bid tape on a Monday, and you would have had to have put in your, you know, initial or final bid by the following Tuesday, for example. The client was themselves was going through the process of continuous evaluation of the loans in the pool, trying to determine which were to be excluded from the final purchase bid.
So
they would do that on a daily basis. Otherwise, at the end of the process, it would just be, you know, much too hectic and much too intense in the way of time to do it all at the very end. So they did it on a daily basis.
While this is going on, has the bid been made, or is the bid process underway and they're using the information that you provide them with to adjust their bid one way or the other?
I really can't answer that question. I don't know if there were times when initial indications of value were given so that they were able to receive the bid tape as you know, one of the final bidders, and then a final bid, you know, was due, you know, by a certain time definite. I just can't speak to that.
All right, fair enough. Over time, you said we started in 2005, and let's not go all the way to 2008, because 2008 things get a little squirrely, or at least. Let's go into early 2007. You mentioned that the average pool sample size was about 10% of the loan pool.
To my recollection, that's right.
Did that percentage go up or down between the time you started and mid 2007?
By the time I arrived in 2005, the average pool size was probably, you know, at that time it was probably on the high side of 10%, but, you know, it probably still wasn't 20%.
Yeah, okay.
Occasionally we would be asked to do sample sizes that may have approached 20%, but generally if, you know, let's say it was on the long side of 10 rather than the short side of 10.
And then afterwards it would have been on the short side of 10.
As time just went forward from 2005 to 2010, the sample sizes probably went from the long side of 10 to the short side of 10.
Okay, fair enough. Tom, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah. The you received a script, and I'm trying to determine whether or not within the script forwarded to Clayton by the client, whether or not there were ranges of tolerances to give the Clayton underwriter some, for lack of a better expression, wiggle room. Was that contained in that materials forwarded by the client?
A script would have had underwriting guidelines, as I recall, that would have gone along the lines of not greater than. So it would have had a debt-to-income ratio, for example, of not greater than 35%. It wouldn't have had a range. It would have had a not greater than. It would have had a loan-to-value range of not greater than, 85%, for example. So
right.
Not necessarily a range, but I would describe it as a not greater than.
But, these parameters... These were guidelines set by the seller, correct? I mean, because the seller would have been making...
I would say the way loans were originated, they were generally originated with identifiable underwriting guidelines. Those guidelines would have, had underwriting criteria that would have said, for example, with loan to values not greater than 95%, or debt to income levels of not greater than 35%, etc. And those would have been established by the originator of the loan.
Right.
At the time the loans were being sold, the underwriting guidelines that were utilized in the origination of the loan and its first underwriting would have been conveyed to the potential buyers of those loans.
Right.
Now, I don't know if that answers your question, but that, to my understanding, is the way these loans were created. They weren't created by the buyers. They were created by the originators, who were the sellers.
That makes sense, because that's also the way they're described in the securitization prospectuses. Mm-hmm. Do you recall any time that a seller would say, these are the guidelines which this thing is underwritten in connection with, let's say 95% loan to value, no more than that. And a buyer is saying, we'd like to buy part of the pool that doesn't have any more than 85% loan to value, for instance? Did that ever happen? I have no idea if it did or didn't, but I'm just... In other words, did you ever get a buyer trying to pick the eyes out of what was being offered? Or was the competitive nature of the business for product at that point just, that wasn't going to play? You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you're saying. And I would have to go back to the timeline. By the time you got to 2005, the buyers were in much less control. The sellers were much more in control. And so the sellers would have created the pools and would have offered the pools to the buying community. If you were to go back to, let's say, the years, if you went back to 1995, just go back 10 years before that,
yeah.
Oftentimes sellers who had much more control at that point would do exactly what you were referring to as cherry picking, at that time I was in the mortgage insurance business, and what we would frequently do in the mortgage insurance business was to say, you know, we would look at a pool when someone came to us and said, would you insure this pool? And we would say, we would insure this pool, but we would exclude from this pool loans that had, you know, greater than 95% LTVs.
Okay.
And at that point, 1995, the providers of the mortgage insurance or the buyers of the pools were very much more in command of the process, and you could do that. By the time you got to 2005, the sellers were in command. The buyers were really the takers of the product and had very little ability to carve up the pools that they wished to buy. And so you either bought the pool, and I recall in conversations with clients that they were told, you know, if you want to buy this pool, you can buy it, but, you know, your maximum carve out could be 2%. So for example, you know, if there were 1,000 loans in the pool, your maximum carve out would be 20 loans. Anything more than 20 loans and you're not a contender to buy, will sell to someone else.
What are carve-outs?
If you think of a range of risk, now, and risk could be any number of factors, loan to value, debt to income, geographic concentration, and you plot each of those on a line from left to right, with the right being the highest risk and the left being the lowest, you know, various buyers may have carved off or carved out some section of risk on the right side of that line.
So basically what you're saying is that they could kick out, based on their due diligence review, they could kick out up to 2%.
Anecdotally, that's what I recall, yes.
And was that of 2% of the amount reviewed or 2% of the entire pool?
You'd probably be better off talking to a buyer about that to get a more specific answer, but I think it was 2% of the total pool.
All right. We talked about in terms of 1995 and 2005. Do you have any information as to when this situation switched from the seller being in control, or the buyer being in control, to the seller being in control?
It was along the times of 2003-04.
All right.
By 2005, the seller was in full control. In 2003-04, it was sort of a, you know, it was more of a interactive negotiation.
And do you have any idea as to the maximum carve-out limitation as to whether, I mean, that's obviously an element of this switch to the seller being in control. Did that become standardized, or was that, you know, once in a while that happened, or do you have any idea?
I do not, I'm sorry.
You just know it happened anecdotally from time to time.
Yeah, I know it happened just, you know, from my acquaintances with clients and, you know, our, you know, sort of lunchtime conversations as to the process.
So, and essentially, other people have talked to us about this, that there was a general feeling if you kicked out too many loans, you wouldn't get invited to the next auction.
That's probably true.
Or that you would get the reputation of being good on the bid but bad on the execution.
That's probably true too.
Okay, that's the phrase we've heard.
What is an exception report?
An exception report that Clayton would have provided?
Yes.
In our reporting back to our clients, we would have listed all of the exceptions by type, and I'm trying to recall how many types we had, but there were many, probably in excess of 20 different types of exceptions that we would have identified and had, you know, specific coding for. And so we would have coded each of those exceptions and given that exception report back to our client at the end of every day.
In the context of the preparation of this report, what was an exception?
An exception would have been a loan that was originated with a debt-to-income ratio in excess of that which the client that which the seller would have stated to the client and the client had accepted as being expected in the portfolio. And again, that would have, you know, that would have had any number of possible exceptions. And many of the exceptions had sort of, you know, had different categories with or different levels within the exception.
Is it fair to say that there were some exceptions that were material and some that were not material?
There were many that were material and there were many that were immaterial. For example, in my review of risk, I would think that factors that affected the borrower's ability to repay the loan would have always been material. Factors that were not would be, you know, immaterial or less material. I remember one buyer of loans who had a stipulation that said, you know, we will not buy loans that are on a high rise above floor number 6, and all of a sudden we had loans that were on floor number 7. You know, to me that would have been not a material exception, but it would have been one that was noted. A loan to value where the loan was 110% of the appraised value, to me was a material exception.
Gotcha. So an exception is a part of the data that is at variance with the underwriting guidelines.
Yeah, an overriding statement, that would be right. Okay. Anything at variance with the guidelines.
I'd like to go back, if I can, a little bit to what I had discussed with some of your colleagues there as being what I've come to call overlays. And that was what we were trying to refer to a little bit ago when we were talking about tolerances. Was it usual to obtain or to have, in addition to the underwriting guidelines, overlays of the guidelines set by the client?
I'm not sure what you mean or refer to as an overlay of a guideline.
Let's suppose that there were guidelines there that were somewhat liberal and we wanted to make them a little bit more conservative or strict or less risky. And I said, okay, and as a buyer or as your client, would I send you some additional instructions to say, I want to see every one of these that is beyond this level? And I know that's not an artful question, but...
That may have happened, and in a specific script we would have complied with that request. I don't know if that was a general rule that would have applied to our underwriting. I just can't speak to that.
Is it the script that is loaded into the class system?
Yes, each client of ours had a script for each loan type that they would be interested in acquiring in a pool. So they would have a script for what we would have called Alt A loans or low doc or no doc loans. They would have had scripts for subprime loans. Whatever the generic type of loan that was identified by a client, they would have had a specific script dealing with that loan type.
What is an exception tracking report?
The tracking report, that was a report that we were developing a lot of reports that exception tracking was one that we were developing when I got there in 2005. That was going to track the number and type of exception that we found, and we were going to try to extend that as far back as we could. So we were going to do it by originator. And then we were going to try and take it back even further, because we were going to try and take it ultimately back to, if we could capture the data in a consistent enough way, take it back to perhaps the originating broker, and then perhaps even back to the originating underwriter. The idea being that, over time, we could track the sources of the best quality and lesser quality loan originators and provide great information to our client about what to expect from a seller based on the history that seller had developed over the time we were tracking it. It was a report that I think we first out in sometime in 2007, but it had it was very much an early level report, so we tried to have it with we tried to produce it with great accuracy, but the level of data that we were collecting because we had to go back to 2005 to try to create these reports, and we were using data from 2005, 6, and 7. The level of data that we captured was generally inconsistent. So the level of output on the reports was okay, but it was never anything that I thought at the time we released them, you know, had a very high accuracy or effectiveness. It would have, you know, if we had been able to continue with that over 3 or 4 years, I think certainly by now, 2010, had Clayton been doing that, they would have been able to capture much of the data that we were hoping for on a consistent basis, and would have been able to identify brokers, underwriters that generally were weaker than others. But I don't think it ever went very far.
Based on your exception tracking reports and other data available to Clayton, would you agree that from 2005 to 2007 that the underwriting of mortgage loans, those underwriting standards deteriorated significantly?
I would agree that the underwriting standards deteriorated. I don't know that I would be able to attribute anything in our tracking reports that would correlate that, though.
Well, for example, I'm looking at an all Clayton summary report relating to reject and waiver rates, and the two notes that appear in the summary points are as follows. Event 1 findings decrease steadily over the report period. And presumably an Event 1 finding is that this is an acceptable loan. And then it says, an Event 2 findings increased over the first three quarters of the report period before steadily decreasing the remaining three quarters. And what I'm trying to get at is, what is it that you think that data indicates, or those statements indicate to you?
Well, I'd have to take the statements and really look at it in conjunction with all of the underlying data. Taking those, footnoted statements on their own, I honestly don't know that I could attribute anything meaningful to that. I just don't want to give you the impression that in and of itself those comments or that string of data that you may be looking at was highly significant. I'm not saying it's not, but I don't know that you should give it a high level of significance in your reviews.
What did you do with these data points, these reports? What did Clayton do with them?
Generally, Clayton would have reviewed them with the client from whose data this was compiled.
And did, in fact, Clayton engage in those type meetings?
To my knowledge, we did a few, yes.
Were you a participant in any of them?
No, I was not.
Was this data or data like it reviewed or shown to the rating agencies?
Not to my knowledge.
Were there meetings between Clayton and Moody's, S&P, or Fitch, to your knowledge?
Sure. We met with them occasionally to review any number of developments in the industry. We were always trying to encourage them to either utilize our data or, even more important, incorporate our data findings in their own ratings analyses. So yes, there were any number of meetings that would have taken place between Clayton and the rating agencies.
What would have been the effect of the rating agencies incorporating your data into their analysis, if you know?
I really can't say, because I really don't know. I don't know very much about their underwriting models. What I do know about their models is that they had a different underwriting approach than we did. Their underwriting was what I would call macro based, and ours was what we would refer to as micro based, i.e., we looked at individual loan files on a sample basis. the rating agencies would have looked at the macros, so that they would have looked at a loan tape or bid tape, and they would have said the average loan to value on in this pool is 92% with a high of 95 and a low of 87, and therefore that has a, you know, a factor of. They would have looked at loan to values, they would have looked at debt to incomes in the same way, and they would have included those ranges or those or that data in their underwriting model then to predict ultimate delinquencies and ultimate losses.
Did you personally attend any of the meetings with Moody's or S&P in 2007?
I did. I attended a meeting with, I believe, each of them in 2007. It was probably late in 2007, second half of 2007 sometime, after the initial crises had developed, after delinquencies had risen dramatically, the first losses had been developing above expectations, you know, the events at Bear Stearns had unfolded. And so we, I went to the rating agencies, met with some senior representatives of the agency, of the rating agencies, and was trying to see if there was a way in which we could get the rating agencies to utilize the outcomes of our own Clayton's own underwriting analytics, and to somehow incorporate those into their own underwriting and ratings reviews, you know, we went there with the intent of showing them the nature and the amount of data that we collected, and how that data could be, we thought, how that data could be utilized in their underwriting and perhaps incorporate more of the microanalysis in their macro views.
Did Clayton prepare handout materials specifically in connection with these meetings?
I'm sure we did. I don't have any copies of it, but I didn't think that you did. There with a pretty good stack of handouts to show them that our data collection, compilation, and utilization was full and could be helpful to them.
Mark, to the extent that you have those readily available, could you get me just a couple of them, or just exemplars, if you will?
That's in the New York production you have. I can send you the base ranges for that.
Yes,
there's a section on rating agency materials, and the handout that was given at the Moody's, I think it's September 07 meeting, that complete binder is in the production.
Super. Thank you very much for that.
Mr. Phillips, you mentioned that you agreed that there was a deterioration of underwriting standards, and I'm trying to understand how you came to that conclusion. Is it a case of the guidelines became more permissive over time, or is it a case of there were more compensating factors over time, so that essentially there were more twos than there used to be and probably less ones? Or is it that over time the people at the originator were sloppy and there were more mistakes? What do you mean when you say there was underwriting standards deteriorated? Or was it a combination of all of the above, or something else?
I think it well let me preface what I'm going to say by saying that my view of underwriting standards and the quality of the underlying standards, the quality of the underlying mortgages that were underwritten, was colored as much by my general knowledge and dealings in the industry for the last 15 years as it was by my specific findings at Clayton over the 2 year period or 3 year period, 05 to 07. When I was at Radian, I saw toward the end of my tenure at Radian, I saw underwriting standards deteriorating. I saw more underwriting guidelines being liberalized, i.e., higher loan to values, higher debt to income ratios, higher geographic concentrations in pools. And so I saw all of that happening. I saw the development of a greater percentage of no income, no asset loans being originated in 2005 than had been originated in 2003. I saw a higher penetration of subprime loans in 2005 than I saw in 2003. You saw a lower penetration of the GSEs in the general market in 2005 than you saw in 2003. So when I say that I saw underwriting standards and loan quality deteriorating, it's not because I saw anything specific in a Clayton due diligence report. It was because of my general understanding and general awareness and general intimacy with the mortgage market and all of the loan types and all of the underwriting standards and the general securitization volume that was occurring, that I say that I saw that happening. With regard to the specifics of Clayton, yes, we also saw the same things occurring, but my view was at a much higher, at a much higher level than just the specifics of the Clayton due diligence report. It was dealing at a more global industry level than just that.
All right. Thanks for clearing that up. I appreciate that.
Sure.
And that's helpful, too. I lose track. Was Clayton a public company under you, or was it were you owned by private equity players at that point?
The company was owned by private equity firm until March of 2006 when I, as the CEO, led an IPO. And we became a public company in March of 2006.
All right. In connection with that, you guys must have put together a prospectus, is that right?
Absolutely.
And you basically are aware of the rules the SEC has with regard to prospectus content?
Generally.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. And what was your understanding that your clients were doing with this information that you were providing them during your 6 day or several day to 2 week review? In other words,
what were our clients doing with the information?
Yeah, what do you think they did with it?
I think they reviewed our findings. They would generally go back to the seller with results that we found and that they also may have found. I think they may have attempted to carve out some loans from the security pool, from the loan pool. And I think that they would have attempted to reprice the loan pool purchase based on the filing, the findings, if there were a higher than normal exception.
And to the extent there was agreement that loans were kicked out, There would be a natural adjustment. Tell me if I'm wrong about this. My understanding, they bid on a percentage of each loan, so they'd buy the loans at the price they determined based on the information they were given on the tape was 99%. So if they kicked out three loans, then the principal value of those three loans would get kicked out at 99%. Is that basically how it worked?
I've never participated in that level of pricing decision, so I can't speak to that.
All right. So at that point, your client then turns around, buys the loans, and he securitizes them. Right?
Our client would buy the loans, probably with the intention of securitizing them.
It wouldn't necessarily be securitized. He could have taken them on his own books.
Could have.
Or taken them on his own books for a while with a view towards securitizing later.
Also a possibility.
Right. Is it safe to say that Clayton never provided the seller with enough information to adequately describe the entire loan pool for securities law purposes, given what you know about securities laws and your experience at Clayton?
You mean the buyer?
The buyer, excuse me, I said seller, you're right. Thanks, Mark.
Clayton reviewed a sample size which was more or less 10%.
Right.
I don't know if that's statistically significant enough to be disclosed in an SEC filing.
So if it wasn't statistically significant enough, then maybe that wasn't... Well, do you want to, before we get to that, do you understand what the buyers were saying about the loan pools and their meeting of the originator's guidelines in their prospectuses? Do you ever look at that disclosure?
I haven't looked at that disclosure in a number of years. What I recall from that disclosure was that there were significant risk factors identified, and those risk factors were, I mean, the last time I read one of those risk factor statements in a prospectus on a non-conforming or non-agency mortgage-backed security, it would have sounded like something out of a dredge pool.
Fair enough. But you also are pretty sure that they never referred to your due diligence process. Or the results of your due diligence process, your reports in there.
I never saw anything that in the filing that referred to our specific findings. No, and I don't know of any that did.
All right.
Let me interrupt for a second. When was it, Mr. Phillips, that Clayton began to identify loans as two W's?
I honestly don't recall.
Do you know what a 2W is?
I can't recall, to be honest.
It's all right. Okay. What about the sample size? Were the samples done on a random sample, to your knowledge, or were they done on an adverse sample? And what's the difference between the two?
Well, I don't know which may have been done on an adverse and which may have been done on a random.
Yes.
I know some of ours were done on each basis. The difference is that a random sample would have been more indicative of the performance of an entire pool. An adverse sample would have been one wherein the client would have already done some preliminary screening, had chosen loans that they thought may have had particular negative underwriting standards present at the time, and wanted us to do a much more extensive re-underwriting of a file, and had it been an adverse sample, probably would not have been as indicative of the overall performance of the pool as a random sample would. Statistically, I think that would be correct.
Are you familiar with the fact that there was a trade association that was putting together standardized guidelines for third-party due diligence providers after the financial crisis?
Was it? I've heard of it, but I don't know what may have come out of it.
All right. When you took Clayton Holdings public, you went through a due diligence process, and the object of it was to provide investors with a complete and accurate description of Clayton Holdings and its business and its prospects, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. If that same standard was being applied to a mortgage pool, in other words, to provide investors with a complete and accurate description of what's in the pool, would you say that Clayton's review process was sufficient to be able to do that?
I don't think Clayton's review process was ever designed to do that, so I can't imagine how in and of itself it would have been sufficient to make those kinds of disclosures.
Yeah, you weren't looking to do that. You were looking to help your client with the negotiation of the sale, to making sure that your client was buying what the seller had told him he was selling.
That's correct. Our job was to review the loans that had already been originated, had already been closed, and had already been packaged in a way that, and so our job was to review the loans that were in the sample to give the buyer of that pool an indication of how accurate the representations were of the seller with regard to the compliance to the individual underwriting guidelines that were believed to have been used in the original underwriting.
But that your review was limited to the extent that the buyer put parameters on it early. In other words, you don't know if the sample was statistically significant or, right?
That's correct.
All right. So you wouldn't be able to say anything necessarily about the non-sample portion of the long pool.
Absolutely.
All right. So if there were significant, warts on the mortgages you reviewed, you understand what I say when I mean warts. Let's say there were threes. They didn't meet guidelines and there were no compensating factors. There is some likelihood, if it was a 10% sample, that there were significant warts on the 90% that weren't tested.
If you were to assume that the sample was created in a true random fashion, and the sample that we reviewed had a 10% 3 rating, statistically you could assume that the pool at large would have had a 10% 3 exception rating as well. Yeah.
And on the other hand, if it were adversely selected and the buyer was brilliant, in theory, he could have picked all the bad loans for you to review, and that would have, and there wouldn't have been any bad loans in the 90%.
In fact, if the buyer had their own statistical diligence sampling, their own diligence automated sampling review capability.
Right.
They could have run the original bid tape through their underwriting screens.
Right.
Which would have then kicked out the high-risk profile loans.
Right.
If the buyer then gave that subset of high-risk profile loans to Clayton to review further, then you would assume that a very high percentage of those may have been Category 3 loans.
That's a lot of ifs. Did you ever get the impression from your clients that that's what they were doing?
I can't say that I ever did, but by the same token, I would think some clients may have thought that's what they were doing.
Good choice of words. They may have thought that that's what they were doing. That would indicate to me that they may have thought that, but that in some cases that might not have been the case. Is that what you're trying to say?
Not every screening system or profiling subsystem was as accurate in 2004 and 5 as they probably would be today.
Yep. To tell you, is it safe to say if they were that good, they might not have needed you guys? Or is that being too cruel?
No, it's not being cruel at all.
All right.
We have looked and have spoken to Vicki Beal and, of course, to Kerry O'Neill, and we have recently discovered or have found, had provided to us graciously by counsel, a document entitled All Clayton Summary Reports, Reject and Waiver Rates from the First Quarter of 2006 through the Second Quarter of 2007. Are you familiar with that document?
I can honestly say I am not. Not that specific document, no.
All right. But we've already talked with them about that and don't need to bother you with it. Did you have occasion to meet in 2007 with representatives of Deutsche Bank? And so I believe it was maybe August 2007, perhaps September, I'm not sure.
I met with representatives of Deutsche Bank a couple of times. They were a large client of ours. I honestly just don't remember. I'm sorry, I don't remember the specific time period that you referenced, but I don't remember.
Well, was there a time when a document, a trending report, are you familiar with the Clayton trending reports?
I am, yes.
When a trending report had been presented, and what was the purpose, by the by, of the generating the trending reports?
Well, it's a long answer, so please bear with me. When I got to Clayton in 2005, I saw that we had a lot of data collected on the front end. I saw that we were capturing lots of performance data on the back end in our surveillance company. And strategically, it was my goal to try to develop a tool or a set of tools that would become predictive of loan performance. And so what we were trying to do was to capture all of the data that we had on the front end of loans that was captured through the due diligence process, and then match up that data with the performance of the same or similar data on the back end, and to be able to create a predictive model by marrying those two sets of data that would allow us to predict delinquencies, defaults, foreclosures, and ultimate losses that would develop from pools of loans that had, you know, various similar characteristics. And so we set out to capture that data and then to track that data. And as I say, we were sort of capturing it on the front end and sort of backwardating it on the back end. And I'm sorry for that slang, but we were trying to marry the two and get to that predictive analytic product. In trying to do that, we were developing lots of reports. Using front end data, and trending reports were one piece of that package. The trending reports, in and of themselves, from my viewpoint, were not very useful at the time. They were sort of snapshots of things. But they didn't have a, because the data that we were capturing over the time period 2005, 6, and early 7 was not statistically consistent. It meant that the output was a good snapshot, but not necessarily good enough to be statistically relevant. So it was, it was an early, almost a prototype kind of thing, but it was not in and of itself what I would say was a hard tool. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but I think it's important to get a little bit of the background of where we were going or where I wanted to go with the company, and how this one particular thing may have been developed and its relevance and usefulness or uselessness, as the case may be.
Is it fair to say that partially this was based on your experience in the industry, and you saw that default rates were starting to climb, and that it would be useful for your clients and the rating agencies to understand why?
My experience in the industry, especially my experience at the mortgage insurance company, where we had just collected for decades massive amounts of data and had, highly predictive analytics, led me to believe that the data we were capturing at Clayton could also be used to create predictive analytics as well. So that was the path that I was taking the company on.
So it wasn't necessarily spurred on by the fact that you saw a deterioration in underwriting standards?
No, it was not. It was spurred on because I thought we could create a high value-added product that we could sell for a high value-added margin.
And the reason that you would get higher value-added is because it would predict something that was very useful, right?
Exactly, yes. It would predict ultimate losses in a loan pool. That was my ultimate objective.
And by the time 2007 rolls around, you and the people at Clayton would think that being able to predict those sort of things would be valuable to people who are securitizing mortgages.
Absolutely, yes.
Because by that time, the delinquency rates are going up.
Delinquency rates in early 2007 had started trending upward, yes.
All right. Well, I understand your answer with respect to the trending reports. However, I look at something called a reject and waiver rates. Is that is not part of your trending report, is it? That's a standalone reject and waiver rate summary. Is that correct?
I'm not sure exactly which report you're talking about, but it sounds like something we would have completed at the end of every assignment.
Okay. But You mentioned that trending reports weren't necessarily that useful. In trying to capture this data and marry it with the other end of it, were there reports that were useful, you thought?
Well, the trending reports, remember, were just early production reports. In 2007, we first started the preparation of those reports. They hadn't been prepared long enough for them to have been perfected. We were mostly developing them, showing them to clients, getting feedback, trying to get feedback, so that we could make them much more relevant, much more useful to our client. I haven't spent time with the reports that you may have seen, so I can't speak to them specifically. But a trending report is just that. It will show a trend from the captured data, and can be plotted on a line and run through various correlations. But in and of itself, it's just that. It's a snapshot of things that have occurred.
All right. We talked about talking to the rating agencies. Were you doing that in order to provide the rating agency? I mean, I understand the sell side of this, okay? But were you offering this to the rating agencies because you thought it may help them with their rating process, which at that point in time had become subject to some question?
We at Clayton had always thought that had the rating agencies been incorporating some of our findings into their modeling, that would have provided them with better modeling capabilities. Because, again, as I said before, they had a macro approach, we had a micro approach, and if they would have been able to incorporate some of our micro findings into their approach, we always thought they might have been able to fine-tune their modeling a little bit better. But the primary reason for going to see the rating agencies was to try to get them to incorporate our findings into their analysis, require all of the securitizations to have third-party external diligence undertaken, and to disclose the findings of that. We at Clayton didn't have the ability to impose those standards on the industry. We thought the rating agencies could, and we thought that they should.
And I don't know if you've seen the MassAG's submission to the SEC with regard to new proposed regulation AB?
I have not.
They think you should, too. They think they should, too.
Well, just as an aside, I think, as an industry participant for the last 18 years, I would say that investors in general would benefit from more disclosure, more complete and accurate disclosure, more transparency about the nature of risk elements and risk components included in any asset-backed security, rather than just, the general, as I said before, pool dredging that's included in the risk characteristics in these securitization files. The investment community is a pretty sophisticated community. They have analytical tools that will allow them to use this data if the data is provided to them. We always thought that the data that we captured and gathered was highly useful data to the ultimate investors. And providing it to them, I think, would make for a better informed investment community.
Was it ever part of Clayton's strategy to try to become some sort of a certified expert, like an auditor is, with regard to SEC filings? Do you know what I'm saying? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and the answer is no.
Never part of that. Okay.
Who were your competitors in this market, Mr. Phillips?
Oh gosh. Two largest competitors were a company called Bohan, a company called Waterson Prime. Those are the two largest. Then there were a number of smaller ones whose names escape me right now.
What was your approximate market share? Do you have any sense of that?
We used to guesstimate that it was somewhere between 40 and 50% of the due diligence market.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sort of, there were no industry statistics compiled anywhere, but that was kind of our guesstimate.
What, there was a time, 2003, 2004, 2005, when Clayton Holdings was engaging in the due diligence for on behalf of Countrywide. But in 2006, it disappeared. What happened?
I don't recall specifically. I honestly don't recall.
Well, I was looking in 2003 where you did 95% of their work, and then 2004, 85%, and 2005, 75%. And it had to have been a significant portion of your business, and I'm just wondering what happened.
Well, 2003 and 4, I wasn't there. 2005, I was there. I recall that we couldn't, in a couple of cases, we couldn't meet Countrywide's demands for people. But I don't recall anything more than that. And then there was, you know, perhaps a falling out amongst them as a client and us as a provider. But I don't remember any specific trigger.
Okay. You were replaced in that business by a firm called DMG. Do you know who they are?
I do not.
You never heard of them?
No, sir.
All right. Y'all have any more questions? As is typical in these proceedings, when we get about to this point and we are close to being finished, we generally ask the person, the witness, what they think the causes of the financial crisis were. And you now have the floor, sir.
I got to get to lunch soon. seriously. Gosh. The causes of the crisis. You know, if I look back over the years that I was in this, that I have been in the mortgage-related businesses, there was, let's go back to the late 80s when there was the last financial mortgage crisis. Coming out of that, underwriting standards in the early 90s were very tight, very strong, and the mortgage business that was originated throughout the 90s was of very high quality. It performed very well, and it provided the investors in mortgage risk generally, be they originators, be they securitizers, be they insurers, with very high returns on their invested capital. That also goes to the investors in mortgage-backed securities. And what that led to was because the returns were so high, it led to more competitive entries into the market in all areas. As that increased capacity came into the market, whether that was investors, insurers, originators, underwriters, they all became more competitive. They all wanted a bigger market share. Trying to gain market share, you do it in any number of ways. You cut price, you cut quality, you cut time to deliver. By the time we got to 2005, participants in the industry had cut each of those things. They cut price for risk, they cut time to underwrite it, they cut quality in their underwriting. They became much more aggressive because they were using models that had been created in 1999 and 2002 for delinquencies and foreclosures and ultimate losses. What they failed to realize was that the basic product had changed in many of its components. The percentage of Alt-A, you know, no-doc, low-doc loans increased. Not that the underlying product was bad, but the percentage of those loans in the marketplace was much higher, which meant that the quality was much lower. The percentage of subprime loans increased. Again, not that there is anything wrong with a subprime loan in and of itself, but the quality had deteriorated because the quantity had increased. And so as each of those elements of the market expanded, the overall quality continued to decline until you got to 2006, when I think it was about 40% of the mortgages that were originated were no-doc, low-doc, subprime loans, which were just extraordinarily badly underwritten. And therefore the assumptions that were used, which correlated back to the performance of 2001 and 2, were simply wrong. They were no longer valid underlying assumptions for the loans that were being created in 2006. Performance was totally, was going to be totally different. In 2002, underwriting assumptions were that 8% of the loans would be subprime. In 2006, it was probably 18 to 25% of the loans were subprime. So the overall quality of the product that was being underwritten was just much lower. And even if it was written to good, low standards, it was still a low-quality product. Plus, you had extraordinarily high property appreciation that occurred in the early 2000s. That was probably fueled by the aggressive buying that was facilitated by the aggressive lending. And that property appreciation stopped in 2006 and, in fact, reversed. So you had the reversal of property appreciation along with underwriting standards that had declined, and you had a classic market meltdown as a result. So, you know, in 1,000 words or less, that's it.
Which, was it the demand for securitization that required the production of the mortgages, or was it the mortgage volume, the mortgage quantity that fed the securitizations?
You know, that's a very good and interesting question, and I have a view on it. I believe it was the demand for the mortgage securitizations on the part of the investors that led to feeding that, you know, that fire. If you go back to the late 90s, the investors in mortgage securitizations were achieving extraordinarily high returns on their investment. The senior pieces were being sold at, I don't know, 200 to 300 over treasuries. The subordinated pieces, you know, higher than that, and the residuals were returning 25 to 30% return on investment. that leads to a great demand for that product. And so the demand for that product caused the need to fill the demand, which I believe generated the willingness of people to stretch the underwriting standards to satisfy the demand for loans, to satisfy the demand for securities. But that's just my observation.
Where were these investors? Who was driving this market? Was it the foreign banks? Was it Fannie? Was it Freddie? Who was it that was driving the demand for these mortgage securitizations?
Well, originally it was, again, go back to the late 90s, it was the sophisticated investment funds, mostly domestic. But as the securitizers were then able to demonstrate very high returns, that broadened the market demand. And what you saw then were less sophisticated investors getting involved, you know, to the point where I remember reading about, you know, some Japanese fishing community cooperative bank investing in mortgage-backed securities and taking a loss. You know, for the life of me, I could never imagine why some communal bank in the outer islands of Japan would ever be investing in a U.S. mortgage-backed security, but they did, and they got burned for it because they weren't sophisticated. They didn't have the data to do the analytics, and they didn't have the data in the securitization profiles of the prospectuses that would have allowed them to do it had they been able to do it.
Was it just relied on the ratings?
So they relied on the ratings, which relied on bad models to produce those ratings.
Well, I really appreciate that last series of comments. It's very helpful to us and happens to coincide completely with my view of things. And thus, I have to say that you're a very astute gentleman.
Well, I would return that.
We heard something similar from another leading light in this industry. He said that he couldn't prove it statistically, but his feeling was that in the end, more loans were sold than bought. And what he meant by that was there was this machine that was out pushing people to take out loans as opposed to people naturally just coming in and applying for loans and it has something to go with whether or not they were telling the truth or were encouraged to tell the truth when they applied.
What he says was they didn't come in there intending to lie necessarily. And he says that looking at the geographic distribution of these types of loans, it leads him to conclude that these loans were sold and not bought. What do you think?
Well, I don't have any empirical evidence personally to support or refute that. But I do know the number of refinancing offerings I received in my own hard mail box and email box every day for the period 2004 to 5 and 6. And I would tell you there probably wasn't a day that went by when I didn't have an unsolicited offer to refinance my mortgage. So, you know, anecdotally, I would agree with the fact that more loans were sold and sold to the borrower, yes.
Right.
It was hard to avoid some of those, and if you're an unsophisticated borrower and you've got a mortgage outstanding and someone says, I can lower your payments by $200 a month and lower your interest rate, it's hard for an unsophisticated borrower to not take that bait.
Mr. Phillips, on behalf of the FCIC, we very much appreciate your having taken the time to speak with us. It's been extraordinarily informative and very helpful to us, and for that I thank you.
Well, you're quite welcome.
And I look forward to meeting you face-to-face, so to speak.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Take care.
Good day.
Good tape.
Time is...
Yeah. We're definitely off.
12:50.
Say again? We're definitely